Tonight on Standing Room Only, Deep Dialogue, Readings on Race and Ethnicity, Part 1.
Welcome to Standing Room Only, featuring lectures, town hall meetings, and other public forums recorded on location by WFHB community volunteers. This program amplifies voices not adequately represented in mainstream media to help raise public consciousness of issues affecting life in South Central Indiana and beyond.
On September 7th, the Deep Dialogue Project opened in the Indiana Memorial Union with a panel discussion about race, history, community, and healing in contemporary literature. The project is sponsored by the Writers Guild at Bloomington and Indiana University's Office of the Vice President for Diversity, Equity, and Multicultural Affairs, with funding from the Indiana Humanities with support from National Endowment for the Humanities. Maria Hamilton Abagunde and Patsy Ron facilitated the panel, which was comprised of Lisa Kwong, Willie Palomo, John McCluskey, and Tracy Jordan. In this show, you'll hear the first half of the discussion.
Good evening, everyone. Again, if I have said this already to you, welcome again. We are glad to see you. My name is Maria Hamilton Abagunde on campus solely. I am currently the director of the Graduate Mentoring Center and also a faculty member in the Department of African American and African Diaspora Studies. And I want to welcome you to the first part of Deep Dialogue. We're going to do several things this evening. One of them is we are going to just do some general thank yous, right, in terms of gratitude. I will also introduce the panelists before they begin to speak, and I'm going to tell you a little bit about the project. Before we do that, however, I'm going to ask you, so this is how I begin almost everything on campus. Some of you worked really hard to get here. It may have taken you a little bit of time to find it. Some of you are rushing to get from parking. There are so many things that are happening on campus at this particular moment in time. One of the things that we don't do is take time to stop. And so I'm just going to ask us to take a moment and to just breathe. Wherever it is that you are, whatever it is that you're doing, just breathe. Just take a moment and breathe and thank yourselves for being here. And just take a deep breath, inhale through your nose, exhale through your mouth. And again, inhale, exhale. Inhale and hold for 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. And release. Thank you for being here. I'd like to introduce Ms. Patsy Ron, who will bring us to our next part.
Hi, everybody. Welcome. Welcome. We would like to thank Indiana Humanities. They awarded us the award for this, the funding for this, which came through the National Endowment for the Humanities. So we'd like to thank the National Endowment for the Humanities as well. We're very grateful and have a great deal of gratitude that both those organizations exist and continue to exist. We'd also like to thank the Writers Guild at Bloomington. When Abagunde first came up with this project, she thought, the perfect organization for this is the Writers Guild. And it's true, it's a perfect fit. So we thank them for sponsoring us and helping us to do this. And we'd like to thank Indiana University's Office of the Vice President for Diversity, Equity, and Multicultural Affairs. They gave us some funding for this particular panel event, so we'd like to thank them. And we'd like to thank some people who just stepped forward to help us. Yu Yong An, she created and is managing our registration system. and Patrick Petro, who helped step forward and helped us set up and design our Facebook page. So we're very grateful for their help. And of course, we'd like to thank our panelists who have agreed to take part in the project. There's Lisa Kwong, Willie Palamo, John McCluskey, and Jordan. And we'd like to thank LaShonda Crowe-Storm. She will be a co-facilitator in our last workshop, which is, I think, the 30th of September. So, and thank you. Thank you, everybody who's here tonight. And thank those of you who have signed up for the workshops. We very much look forward to meeting with you in the workshop and dialogues.
So what is deep dialogue? That's the question that a number of people ask. It's deep dialogue, readings on race and ethnicity. Over the next 4 weeks, we are asking people to gather together to read works by four authors from different cultural backgrounds, and to engage in a process called the Lectio Divina. Small groups that will be together for about 90 minutes, doing some very mindful and intentional work. So the formal part of this, just so you know, this grant, this In Common grant, is a result of last year's political climate. Indiana Humanities, funded by NEHA, the National Endowment for the Humanities and Legacy of Race and Ethnicity Initiative, put a call out. It was very short. Like, if you blinked, you almost didn't see it. And I'm very grateful to LaShonda Crowe-Storm for actually passing it on to me. And so the purpose of these projects, or the purpose of the funding, was to see creative projects that helped communities use the humanities to talk about race and ethnicity. There were no guidelines for how that should be done, just that the humanities needed to be a central part of that work. The other purpose was to bring together scholars and community and artists, community activists, is part of this conversation. So this project was designed to bring some senior scholars together, like Professor McCluskey, senior writers together, like Lisa Kwong and Willie Palomo, but also graduate students together, Willie and Tracy Jordan, to bring everyone together to actually share work in a way that gives us an opportunity in a very brief time. We can't do the entire history, obviously, right? But in a very brief time to talk about this evening in particular, why the humanities are important. How do they help us understand the historical, social, and political context of the works that we're actually going to read? Why this particular process? This is a process that comes out of the Benedictine tradition. And traditionally, what one would be to read scripture in a way that allowed you to listen to the voice of God or spirit to have a better understanding of what was needed of you. So it asks you to move yourself out of the way. This is a process that I use in my class when I teach, no matter what class I'm teaching. And so this process is being used to help us mindfully and intentionally read works by a Chicano Native American writer, a Native American writer, an African American writer, and an Asian American writer, for us to really consider and give attention to not only their words, but the lives in those words, so that we can, in fact, pay attention to what is being said and how we each say it and interpret it. So we're gonna be asking people in these dialogues to move through some really deep stuff really quickly. So it's good that so many of you signed up together, but it's about trust as well. It's about trust and it's about keeping to the mission of the grant of being able to provide an opportunity for participants to mindfully and intentionally come to the life of someone who is different than they are, not to necessarily interpret it and not necessarily to fully understand it, but to begin to dialogue about what it makes us feel. And after we do all that, how does that work help us on campus, in community, build a better community? So if you're here, I'm imagining that you have some dream of a common language, perhaps, that ought to be enriched, might call, but also a dream, perhaps, that there might be some dialogues and some different things possible for us to live with. So that is what we're doing. That is how we are doing it. I am going to introduce our panelists to let you know who they are, because we work in between the importance of scholarship, the importance of community and activism, knowing that they feed each other. They are integrated in the work that we do, particularly everyone on this panel is an artist, a community activist of some sort, a scholar of some sort. It's important to see how they feed each other. So I'm just going to go down the line in this way. Lisa Kwong, MFA, is an Appalachian writer in the Midwest, where she currently teaches Asian American Studies and English at Indiana University. Her poems and essays have appeared in Anthology of Appalachian Writers, Best New Poets 2014, the Minnesota Review, and other journals. She has received poetry scholarships and fellowships from Indiana University, the Frost Place, and Sundress Academy for the Arts, where she was the 2017 Appalachian Writer in Residence. Welcome, Lisa, and thank you. Willie Palomo is the son of two undocumented immigrants from El Salvador. He is an MFA candidate in poetry and an MA candidate in Latin America and Caribbean Studies at IU. His work can be found in Vinyl, Waxwing, The Wandering Song, Central American Writing in the United States, and on palomapoemas.com. Welcome, Willie, and thank you.
Thank you.
John McCluskey Jr., who I have to say is someone very dear to my heart, who worked me through here at Indiana University with much love and compassion. John McCluskey Jr. is Professor Emeritus of African American and African Diaspora Studies and English here at IU, where he taught contemporary literature and fiction writing. He serves as a senior editor at the journal Kalalu, and as an editor for special projects at the ongoing digital project of the African American Studies Center at Oxford University Press. He is at work on a number of short stories set in historical and contemporary locales. He is an avid fisherman and gardener, and an eager photographer, and an intrepid swimmer and cyclist. Thank you so much, and welcome. Tracy Jordan is a fourth-year PhD student in the Department of Literacy, Culture, and Language Education. Her current research interests include ecofeminist justice, education, activism, and visual and cultural studies.
Visual and cultural analysis.
Yeah. She lives in Bloomington with her two children, dog, rabbit, and four chickens, and spends her limited free time, she says, participating in a variety of justice and activist spaces and actions. Welcome and thank you. So we have invited each of the panelists to speak briefly about the historic and social context, the particular area that they're gonna focus on, talk a little bit about the book, but also to leave time so you all can ask questions. Everybody good with that? All right.
All right, I guess I get to kick things off. So good evening, everyone. I think I'm actually gonna stand. I just feel more comfortable when I'm giving presentations. to stand. So can you all hear me in the back? Okay. So I have been invited to talk about Asian American experiences and history, and also Beyond Heart Mountain by Leanne Rorapaw. So when we think of Asian America, we think of calculus geniuses, kung fu, and Chinese takeout boxes. What we don't always hear or talk about are the 1882 Chinese Exclusion Act, which has influenced immigration laws to this very day, Vincent Chen, a Chinese American man who was beaten to death by a baseball bat by two white men in Detroit in 1982, 500,000 Southeast Asian refugees displaced by the Vietnam War in the 1970s and 1980s, and finally, Japanese American internment, more accurately termed incarceration, during World War II after the attack on Pearl Harbor. So I would say that one role of Asian American literature is to give voice to these experiences that have been whitewashed, ignored, and silenced, to set the record straight on how history has been experienced by Asian Americans. For if we do not tell our own stories, they will not get told. Because Asian Americans are seen as the model minority, our stories are mythologized as having achieved the American dream, that we have successfully assimilated and are self-reliant, and we are honorary whites immune to racism. American history and current society has shown us otherwise. Asian Americans are perpetual foreigners because our English is just so good, and we are America's favorite plague, the yellow peril, here to steal everyone's jobs and Ivy League admissions. Quite frankly, Asian Americans have never been viewed as fully American, but rather we are viewed as a threat to American society. Therefore, another role of Asian American literature is to debunk and challenge these stereotypes. Asian America is not a monolith. There are over 20 Asian ethnicities, so there can never be one single story of Asian America. I want to draw your attention to this issue of Poetry Magazine. It is the July-August 2017 issue, and it focused on Asian American poets, and I would say it's the closest thing we have to a current anthology of Asian American poetry. So I have a few quotes I want to share with you from here. So as Lawrence Min Boyd Davis, founder of the Asian American Literary Review, says, quote, Asian American has always been an inelegant conglomeration of peoples from all across the world, from nations and cultures too disparate to gather coherently and equitably together. But since its coining in the late 60s, Asian American has also been a necessary means of organizing in the face of social injustice, end quote. The Chinese American poet Marilyn Chen once wrote, quote, it is our job as poets to write the poetry of our times, end quote. To further illustrate this, poet and professor Timothy Yu states, Asian American poetry has changed with the context surrounding it. Some of the earliest Asian American poems emerged from the 19th and 20th century experiences of migration, labor, and exclusion. Asian American poets have shaped and have been shaped by the tectonic shifts of modern writing. Asian American poetry is itself a political category. Like the term Asian American, it is a category constantly redefined by new contexts, yet it is also one that demands attention to the intersections of poetics and race. So I'm gonna now focus on the poet and book we'll be exploring in the September 23rd workshop. I'm gonna read you a brief bio of Leanne Rorapaw just to give you some context for her work. And a lot of this is from the Poetry Foundation bio. So a Wyoming native and second generation Japanese American, Wurrupa studied music, earning a BM in piano performance and an MM in music history before earning an MFA in creative writing from IU. So she's one of our own. She is the author of four poetry collections, Beyond Heart Mountain, Year of the Snake, On the Cusp of a Dangerous Year, and Dandarians. In 2015, she was appointed Poet Laureate of South Dakota. So shout out to the Poetry Foundation again. They did give a very brief overview of some of her work. So we get a larger picture of what she's working with before I narrow down to the specific book and poem we'll be looking at. So the overview of her work. So in Beyond Heart Mountain, which is the book we'll be focusing on, Wurrupa drew on her heritage and life in the American West to create a series of portraits in the voices of Japanese American internees at the Heart Mountain Relocation Center in Wyoming. In her second book, In Year of the Snake, she explores issues of mixed race identity, myths, Japanese fairy tales, and metaphors of transformation. And in poems and On the Cusp of a Dangerous Year, she delves into the lives of contemporary women with a nod to Lady Murasaki. So I was very excited when Abegunde and Patsy chose Lee's work for this project, because I feel a sort of kinship with Lee for a few reasons. We both grew up Asian American in places not usually associated with Asian Americans. So for her, that was Wyoming. And for me, that was Appalachia, more specifically the southwestern part of Virginia. Also, both of our works, to some extent, engage with history that we didn't experience, but that is still very much a part of our identity. So for Lee, that was Japanese American incarceration. And for me, it was the experiences my parents had to go through in order to immigrate to the US. It's important that the lesser known experiences of Asian Americans in unexpected locales are told, because again, Asian America is not a monolith and not limited to California or New York. We're in New England, the Rocky Mountain states, the South, and the Midwest. And if you're in Indiana, you might be called a Hoosian, okay? I did not coin that, someone else did, so I can't take credit for that. Okay, so Beyond Heart Mountain is Wurrupa's first collection. The first poem, Pearls, sets the tone for the rest of the book by introducing the themes of family history, Japanese culture, generational conflict between immigrant parents and their American-born children, and racism. There are examples of Japanese culture and language throughout the book, along with very vivid images of the landscape and animals of Wyoming. Persona is also used throughout the book, particularly in the second section, which is a series of persona poems told from the perspective of Japanese American internees and what life was like in the concentration camps. The particular poem that we're going to focus on in the workshop is, and you'll have to forgive me, I'm not Japanese American, or I've not studied Japanese. The poem title is Oyoroshi, which translates into forgive in English. The poem details the friendship between its Japanese American speaker and a Native American girl. The first stanza begins with what seems like the all-American childhood. You've got Jell-O and recess, and we're introduced to the image of a paper cube that they use to give messages to each other. So there's nothing in that first stanza that actually indicates their otherness. However, when we get to the second stanza, we learn that the Native American girl is being bullied while the speaker does nothing. And the interesting choice that that Lee makes is not to reveal her friend's, the speaker's friend's ethnicity until the final stanza. In the third and final stanza, the speaker is the one being bullied, and she realizes her own otherness in that moment by naming her tormentors as white girls and how unfortunately otherness and being bullied is a commonality between her and her former Native American friend. So one of the big takeaways from this poem is even though Asian Americans have been viewed as honorary whites at one point or another, we do have intersections with other communities of color through our histories and experiences. It's necessary for these stories to be told so that Asian Americans can know our own history and how that has shaped our present position in society. I'd like to end with a quote from the poet Tarfia Fazula about the necessity of poetry in telling our stories. The quote is, "We need these arrows to disrupt the noisy lies of dictators. We need to never forget these silences we must record. We need to delight in and reckon with these poems that are unabashedly strange, brave, and bristling with song like each of us. We need to keep tuning in together all along and beyond. Please join us," end quote. So thank you so much for your attention, and I hope to see you all at the workshops. Thank you.
You have been listening to Deep Dialogue, Readings on Race and Ethnicity Part 1, on Standing Room Only, on WFHB. You've been listening to Lisa Kwong speak about the Asian American experience and accompanying literature. She was the first panelist of the Deep Dialogue Project's opening discussion. Per the Writers Guild at Bloomington website, the aim of the project is to introduce members of the Bloomington community to the poetic works of four contemporary writers of different races, ethnicities, and cultures. It also endeavors to engage the community in deep listening about historical and contemporary issues related to race, ethnicity, economics, oppression, marginalization, and healing through these works. It attempts to create a space in which community members can discuss how and where Bloomington is connected to the history and its role in contemporary solutions. It tries to engage the community in the practices of beholding and witnessing, that is, holding respectful space to hear and listen to the stories of others without judgment. Its goal is to create a model of contemplative dialogue that is replicable in different Bloomington communities that will allow them to address and better understand issues related to marginalization and oppression. It aims to create an opportunity for scholars of all levels and community-based practitioners and social justice activists to discuss the historical context of different groups' experiences and possible solutions to move beyond the histories that bind and separate us. And finally, the project is meant to inspire community members to have an appreciation of literature and its ability to be a vehicle to better understand history and themselves. We now return to the show, as Willie Palomo speaks about his experience with Latinx literature.
I want to start by thanking Abagunde for inviting me here. Sharing space with you has helped heal me in a lot of ways, and you having faith in me to be here means a lot to me. She asked me to speak about the role in literature in helping us understand the histories of Latinx people and then the experiences of Latinx people, and then how Jimmy Santiago Baca accomplishes that. I'm going to start by talking very personally about my own engagement with Latinx literature and like my own experience. I grew up in Utah as a very isolated Latino, especially like Salvadoran, where like there was no other Salvadoran I knew. Suburbs, Republican, Mormon, that was kind of the whole milieu I grew up around. And it was very difficult to find, like I had hip hop and that like connected me to like community of color that I could relate to. But there was a lot that I was missing out on that I did not have access to, also because my parents couldn't share it with me. My first time going to El Salvador was when I was 18, and I'll talk about that a little bit more. And what literature has been able to provide for me is my history, my sociology, it's been anthropology, and it's been psychology. Every single time institutions of higher education, educational institutions, repeatedly failed me, it is what has caught me and saved me. I apologize. For many of us that have been silenced in the workplace, in academia, and elsewhere, literature and media are the few platforms where we begin to have crucial conversations that we need to have. The story, the first time I went to El Salvador, I was 18, and I'm like jumped into this like crazy new context that makes no sense to me. And I begin to like understand my parents a little bit more, like, oh, growing up in rural El Salvador, all the different expectations, the way the Civil War kind of impacted our family. And like as an 18-year-old, I was very frustrated one evening as I was going to bed with my mom. And I was like, why didn't you share any of this with us? I was really frustrated with her, and she didn't say anything. There was just a silence in the room. A year later, we went back to El Salvador, and this time my tia was with us. And she was with us the first time when I asked the question, too. And I was like, remember, Mom, when I asked you this question, and you didn't even say anything then? And my tia all of a sudden was like, well, duh, Willie, she couldn't say anything. Like, how the hell are you supposed to, like, translate this entire country and, like, everything we've been through to, like, you in a language that we, like, barely even speak in English? Part of the reason I'm emphasizing the silence so much, it's because it's something that white supremacy takes so much advantage of in our court systems and the prison systems. And just today, I was in a room with a DACA student where there was white people deciding whether she deserved to be treated like other students, whether she deserved in-state tuition. While we were having this conversation, it became clear that like the white man leading the room did not understand like what the basic definition of undocumented. And he himself admitted that he didn't understand why the parents of this individual would make certain choices that they would. Rather than being able to explain ourselves, we were like silenced in that moment. This silence is something that allows people in power to construct whatever narrative they want to people of color. And what literature provides us with a window to do is to have many of these difficult and critical conversations. When you don't, you end up with a student who ends up being treated lesser than her equals and than her colleagues. When you don't have these conversations, you end up having a family structure where there's a lot of bitterness and a lot of misunderstanding and fighting. For me, discovering Junot Diaz was the way I finally had a window to like understand like, oh, this explains like basic family problems that like my parents have. And it opened those conversations for forgiveness and healing up. It wasn't until I found Junot Diaz that I was like willing to like look my dad in the face and like understand all the violence that he put on us when we were younger. Another thing to be thinking about when we talk about the role of literature is that especially when we're talking about Latinx literature, and the Latinx literature I'm closest to and familiar with, we're not just talking about creating a literature, we're talking about creating a culture. It's not just like reading poems, but like the whole format and the culture that's created, the call and response between the audience. Some examples that I wanna highlight is 2 years ago, we had two poets come in, Marcelo Hernandez Castillo and Natalie Sanders of Pico, who are two emerging poets in the Latinx poetry scene. And because of the work that they did and the culture they created while they were here, Undocu Hoosiers Bloomington, which is an activist group I led, began to blossom. When we had our first meeting, there was like 10 people there that were like, I went to this poetry reading, it made me realize this was important and now I'm here. And that is the work and like the culture that certain literatures within Latinx literature promote. I'm also thinking of the New Yorican Cafe. There's a poet, a Latinx poet, Uroyan Noel, who just published a piece in Poetry Magazine talking about how he sees a lot of contemporary Latinx poets and they're on like social media and they get their poem in Poetry Magazine and it's like the best day of their lives and they're so excited about it because Poetry Magazine is so difficult to get into. And he talks about how he laughs at them because when he was young and growing up, Poetry Magazine was whack. Like there was, like it's gotten a little bit better, but that used to never publish any writers of color. And how when he would read Poetry Magazine, he'd always be like, nah, I'm supposed to be in the New Yorican Cafe right now. I'm gonna put this down and go over there and listen to the work that actually feeds me. I'm thinking of poetry slam scenes where there's a culture created that helps nurture writers and like grow them. So when we think about Latinx literature, we also have to think about the environment it's creating, and that kind of mentorship and nurturing going alongside it. And another thing to think about is, even when the halls of literature, like Poetry Magazine, like even IU, has denied Latino writers and scholars the opportunity to have their classes the way they want, to share the work they want, we've been able to create our own literary communities. Hope Alberto doesn't mind that I use this example, but they rejected one of his Latino literature courses. And what he does is bring Juan Felipe Herrera here, who also wasn't allowed in Poetry Magazine until 2016, when he was already U.S. Poet Laureate, to kind of show you just how that works. He had to become Poet Laureate before he could be acknowledged in a space like Poetry Magazine. So moving on to talk about Jimmy Santiago de Vaca. I'm gonna start with a little bit of his bio to kind of just explain how like much of a miracle he is. He was born in 1952 in Santa Fe of Chicano and Apache descent. And he was abandoned by his parents. And at 13, he ran away from the orphanage that his grandmother had placed him in. When Jimmy was 20, he was convicted of drug charges and was sentenced to prison. He was illiterate when he arrived at Arizona State Pen, where he spent 5 years in prison. And here is where he learned to read and write. I also want to say, when I first completed reading this book, was the day I learned that one of the small handfuls of Latinx professors I've had the opportunity to work with at IU also quit his job at IU because they weren't supporting him. He was undocumented through part of his childhood, had to fight his whole way through academia, did more work in the program that he was in than I saw anybody else do, and got like the least amount of credit, to the point that he just left, like many professors of color left. Actually, I've seen 3 professors of color leave that are in the humanities just in my like short 2 years here, which says something about the kind of environment here. And knowledge of people like Jimmy Santiago de Vaca are what we lose when these people aren't granted a space in academia. I needed to find this book like 5 years before now, but I found it now, which like fills me with rage. But I'm also super grateful to find it. I do want to read 2 short passages from Jimmy's, it's on his personal website, that talk about learning how to read while he was in prison. I first came to write poetry as a young man in prison. First came reading from an anthology I stole from a prison jail guard. And he tells us, it was late when I returned my cell. Under my blanket, I switched on a pen flashlight and opened a thick book at random, scanning the pages. I could hear the jailer making his sounds at the other tires, the jangle of his keys and the sharp click of his boot heels intensified my solitude. Slowly, I enunciated the words, put on the rip pull. It scared me that I had been reduced to this to find comfort. I always thought reading a waste of time, that nothing could be gained by it, only by action, by moving out into the world and confronting and challenging the obstacles could one learn anything worth knowing. Even as I tried to convince myself that I was merely curious, I became so absorbed in how the sounds created music in me and happiness, I forgot where I was. Memories began to quiver in me, glowing with a strange but familiar intimacy, which I found refuge. For a while, a deep sadness overcame me, as if I had chanced on a long-lost friend and mourned the years of separation. But soon, the heartache of having missed so much of life that numbed me since I was a child gave way, as if a grave illness lifted itself from me and I was cured, innocently believing in the beauty of life again. I stumblingly repeated the author's name as I fell asleep, saying it over and over in the dark, Wordsworth. Part of what I love about that selection is how universal this experience feels for people who discover writing and have literature save their lives. And when we talk about Latinx literature or any literature by minoritized culture, there's always a danger of being boxed within like, oh, it is just Latinx literature. only covers their subjective experience, can't speak to the larger condition. And what I love about this is it shows how our literature speaks to the larger human condition. Days later, with a stub pencil whittled sharp with my teeth, I propped a red sheaf notebook on my knees and wrote my first words. From that moment, a hunger of poetry possessed me. Until then, I had felt as if I had been born into a raging ocean where I swam relentlessly, flailing my arms in a hope of rescue, of reaching a shoreline I never sighted, never solid ground beneath me, never a resting place. I had lived with only the desperate hope to stay afloat, that and nothing more. But when at last I wrote my first words on the page, I felt an island rising beneath my feet like the back of a whale. As more and more words emerged, I could finally rest. I had a place to stand for the first time in my life. The island grew, and with each page, into a continent inhabited by people I knew and mapped with the life I lived. I wrote about it all, about the people I loved or hated, about the brutalities and ecstasies of my life. And for the first time, the child in me who had witnessed and endured unspeakable terrors cried out, not just in impotent despair, but with the power of language. Suddenly, through language, through writing, my grief and joy could be shared with anyone who would listen. Through language, I was free. Through language, I was free is something hugely monumental for somebody who's like incarcerated to say. He wrote this entire book, Immigrants in Our Land, in the selected early poems entirely while he was incarcerated, after teaching himself to read. One of the most powerful things about it is his ability to feel like uncontainable joy and through these poems and through like the great tenacity of his spirit, despite like being in one of the worst, most crushing, dehumanizing places ever. I'm going to read selections from a poem, A Song of Survival, which is one of his early selected poems in this book, and one of the longer poems. And I'm going to read it chopped up, so you're going to have to read the whole thing later. The mortar, and what he does here is he takes the prison walls and he, like, destroys them with his mind. It's kind of crazy. I'm going to read this part right now. The mortar of these callous walls, what fingers mixed it? From where was the sand taken? Someone knelt here a million years ago and let the sand sift through real fingers. And with thousands of years came someone who thought of building a home, a town, perhaps a city, the best city in the world. And there was water, so precious and little, dampening dry lips of children, men and women, animals and fowls of all kind. Oh, great wall. You remain the sand my grandfather's grandfather touched. Oh, great wall, you have held the bones of my people. You, oh, great wall, are not my memory, are not my enemy. Here the men scrawl their last hopes on you, as did their fathers, 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 journeying into unknown territory, as do their sons who come to prison, yearlings lost on barren rock, motherless, friendless men whose enemies do not inhabit the rock, but men's rocky hearts, as time and more time and more time floods the steel entrails of this beast, as injustice flooded the land back then, and like then, we somehow survive. We somehow survive. Great wall, I have entered the cycle of life again. They built you up with toil and sweat. I break you down with my words, disintegrate you into the wilderness you are. For when I pace my cell, I pace on dust. And when I feel you in my hand, I feel the strum of water. I see gold nuggets and flowers, scratches of those who have passed here. I make my tools, the written word against granite, to bloom the muse each morning that lets me live, learn, and go on struggling. That is all I ask and all I expect of myself, for I am the wall of justice and refuse to crumble. I am the wall of love and can shelter you. I think that the metaphor of the wall is so especially charged right now, especially with DACA being rescinded and kind of the borderlands being at the forefront of a lot of Latinx people's imaginations. Right now, there's community members scrambling to find ways to support DACA and to support undocumented people, calling on congressmen who have failed to do their job fixing the unjust immigration system for decades and who many expect to suddenly be able to fix it now. But there are many unsure of how to take more supportive action or unwilling to make more difficult yet necessary demands. For those at the crux of intersecting oppressions, this poetry and literature provides us with a way of loving and with a way of fighting back. And for many, it is all we have. And thank you.
Hello. Good evening. I'm happy to be here and happy to have been invited here. It's interesting, I think, beginning of a conversation. As listening to the first two presentations, a question popped into my head. Now, wouldn't it be useful, if not mind-blowing, if our senators and representatives, ambassadors and others could recite a poem, let alone the Federalist Papers or the Constitution? But let's start with a poem that they own that they could give back to us in the middle of a speech. I'm going to take a long road to get to where I want to go, but it shouldn't take very long, but I just want to reach back a little bit. A few years ago, I saw a Latin inscription. It may have been on the Hyper Building, because they're all around the Hyper Building. And I had a student who had as many years of Latin as I had, but was too lazy to look up at the time, to tell me what this particular passage meant. And he did it right off the bat. He says it's from Terence, and it simply says, "I am a human being, and nothing human is alien to me." And I said, I wonder about this. Who is this Terence guy? I never got that in my fourth grade Latin class at Middletown High School. Did a little research, and his mother was Nubian, which means African. So this takes us back away to someone already in Roman times, already building us a house, saying, well, okay, let's talk about the universal from the get-go. And the house that I want to invite you into, in my brief comment, is a house of invisibility versus hypervisibility. And in the universal arguments that went place 200 years ago or so, there was a difference. It was a peculiar, exotic, other person that we talked about. But we all knew that in some biological way, we were universal. Our brains, our hearts, our livers weighed about the same. When we got 6 years old, our two front teeth would fall out. So this is pretty much around the world. So that was easy. And so when we got to this particular place in literature, the people who had been brought here as slaves had a big mountain to climb in terms of creating a literature in this particular climate. The oral traditions existed in Africa and the South. We don't have to go into that. The cases have been made very clearly about how people express themselves gracefully, eloquently, in tales, and in poetry, in song, and also attached to dance. I want to begin quickly with the slave narratives of the United States and eventually getting us to the poet who is before us today. And the slave narratives that were written by people who were themselves not born literate, but people who had a story to tell. And the trend seemed to be or became, I write, therefore I am. You showed that you were a person by writing your life story. And these stories always begin, I was born. Now that's key, I was born. I didn't drop from some other place, I was born on a certain day, in a certain time, in a certain place, if we could find that thing out. Now I call them slave narratives, as most of the critics of my generation call them, but think of another way of talking about the very same thing. And what if we call them the narratives of captive Africans? That changes it immediately, okay? We're no longer talking about slave narrative. We know what slaves, you know, represented, but as captive Africans. So captive people had to learn languages, they had to learn customs, they had to learn a number of things to make it in this country. But what is key here, I feel, is that they were very slyly stories of civilization, because it was no longer the so-called civilized person who had been captured by Indians, Native Americans on the frontier. These were the so-called civilized people who themselves were doing the captivity. So the people were asking, as they looked out through the prism, who in fact are the civilized people? That's the story we still have today. So what does it mean to be a civilization? What does it mean to be civilized? but what does it mean to be a human being? Those are the questions that Phyllis Wheatley was asking, the questions that Richard Wright was asking, the questions that Frederick Douglass was asking, the questions that remain today with Toni Morrison and others on the table today. The other thing I want to add, too, with the notion of literacy and civilization is the notion of citizenship, thus the title of this particular book. I love the title, Citizen. A citizen has a weight that sometimes we take for granted. But go with me to the novel, the autobiography of Miss Jane Pittman by Ernest J. Gaines, one of his master works. And Ned Douglas has come back from the war, the Civil War, to address the young people of the plantation in Louisiana. And he knows he will be killed for giving this lecture to the children. But he tells them, you're not colored people, you are Black Americans, and therefore you are citizens. Citizens mean you have rights, or you should be guaranteed certain rights or privileges. Okay? Start there. You are now no longer an object, you are a subject of your own desires, of your own will. And he tells us to children in a language that's beautiful, very simple. In one paragraph, he takes us from literacy to citizenship and the power of bringing those and keeping those two concepts together.
You've been listening to John McCluskey and others speak about race, history, community, and healing in contemporary literature. And this has been part one of Deep Dialogue, Readings on Race and Ethnicity. Part two will include the rest of McCluskey's presentation, Tracy Jordan's section of the panel, and a question and answer period.
You've been listening to Standing Room Only. Join us each week for on-location recordings of lectures, town hall meetings, and other public forums. If there's a particular event you'd like to hear broadcast on this program, email that information to us directly at news@wfhb.org. The Standing Room Only archive is available online at wfhb.org/news. Standing Room Only is a production of our volunteer-powered news and public affairs department here on Community Radio, WFHB.